What I'd like to do is speak first about voluntary act, if the court's okay with that. I think that kind of keys into to everything in the brief except for factual sufficiency, which I'm not going to take much time arguing. You think that's a good idea? So the law on voluntary act has really been pretty consistent, and since the 70s with the Court of Criminal Appeals. And I can tell you the three things that they say. One, engages in conduct when the conduct includes a voluntary act or omission paired with the proper culpable mental state, the appropriate culpable mental state, that if such conduct includes an involuntary act, then that does not necessarily destroy the voluntariness. And even if the actor did not intend the particular result that occurred, that does not necessarily make it a non-voluntary act. George versus State was a Court of Criminal Appeals case that is heavily cited in both of the briefs. And George versus State brought us the other part of the analysis, and that is where a third party causes the act, or if the act is caused by something other than the person's own volition, then we have the possibility of a voluntary act issue. Well, according to this court's precedent on that, and the automaton defense, if she could prove that with something other than her just saying, I don't know what happened, then I think you'd get an issue. The Court of Criminal Appeals in that case, in George, gave us three examples. One of them was Dockery versus State, 542 Southwest 2nd, 644. Where a man was sleeping on the floor, apparently holding a loaded cocked pistol, and somebody woke him up at 1 in the afternoon, and he started up and shot him. The court held that there was no voluntary act instruction required.
What was the year of that, though?
That case, Your Honor, was all the way back in the 70s, 1975.
Okay.
Court of Criminal Appeals. Another, and I'm bringing it up because it was cited in George in the analysis.
Uh-huh.
And Withers versus State was also spoken about, and it is 631 Southwest 2nd, 595. And this is a man and his wife sitting there. The man is cleaning the gun. Wife is playing with a puppy. The puppy jumps in the man's lap, and he shoots the wife. And he wanted to... and it was in a process of shooing the puppy away. But whatever it was, even though he said it was accidental, it was still a voluntary act. But then George brings up Garcia versus State, which is two men walking along. One man has a pistol, and he says, I'm going to throw this pistol in the canal. The other man jumps to grab the pistol, grabs his arm, grabs at his hand, and gets shot. The court reversed that case and held that you have to give a voluntary act instruction.
But, Greg, this is my problem, and that is there used to be an instruction on accident, and this Court of Criminal Appeals has said no more instruction on accident. There used to be circumstantial evidence instruction. This court has said no more circumstantial evidence instruction. This court seems to be lumping everything together in the elements of the offense, and that it's simply not guilty. And there used to be a time when we thought you had to have a mens rea as well as an actus reus, and this court has explained to us that you don't even have to have a mens rea anymore. They're in the process, apparently, of doing away with that, too. So how do we go back to the 70s and 80s and pick up something that this court has said we don't have anymore?
Well, two things, Justice Dofino. One is the case that you just talked about where they said there's no accident. That was a 1982 opinion, Williams versus State.
And 84 is accurate.
Yeah. And since then, there's been a lot of law that's come down out of the Court of Criminal Appeals talking about a voluntary act instruction. There was a case that I can't recall where Judge Price dissented, saying that voluntary act ought to just be part of the culpable mental state. Mm-hmm. But he was dissenting. And Brown...
That the old law is still good.
Well, I don't recall him saying anything about accident. But Brown versus State, which was a man bumped from behind while he's holding a pistol, mm-hmm. supposed to get a voluntary act instruction, that's from 1997. So I think, and Peavy even, you know, and the jurisprudence that's starting to develop around the automatism defense, it speaks to a third party having something to do with it. That if the act did not occur by the defendant, if some third party intervened, then it's an issue whether it's a voluntary act.
Hey, I didn't bring the penal code with me. Where can I look to see exactly what you wanted? I see 603B on page 7 of the state's brief. Is it in one of these briefs? Is that language you want?
Your Honor, that's 601A right. Is actually the voluntariness thing. That
is it here somewhere to look at? That's what I would ask.
Can I approach? I'll just give you this little copy that I got.
We all are looking at what it is you wanted. Yeah.
Okay.
See?
Okay. All right. So I think that from the standpoint of the voluntary act issue, because we have the third party and because of the state of the evidence, the issue was raised, and that egregious harm is really the number one issue when we're talking about the voluntary act. Now, we'll get to concurrent cause in a minute, and that's a whole different deal. I believe that there was egregious harm, and I have made kind of a little outline, and I would be pleased to do something in 7 days and submit it to the court. Better brief in this part, too. But if you look at the jury charge, the closing arguments, and the testimony of Jamie Becker, in particularly in Volume 4 at pages 219 to 220 and 222 to 225, where she speaks about the fact that a person could pull the shotgun. And then there's the part where the prosecutor believes I misrepresented something to the court, but I think it's highly ambiguous. And that's that page 222, line 23, to page 225, line 6, where you just, if you read the record and can't tell where they were standing in the courtroom or how they were standing, then it really could kind of go either way. But look at the jury charge, and that's at page 31 in the record. The knowingly instruction. I'm sorry.
Yeah, that's why we keep asking
record,
for appendices.
So we can't all bring the record in with
you. Well, it's just the standard knowingly instruction. When he's aware.
Okay.
Did you see how that aware that the circumstances exist? Well, aware that the circumstances exist would allow a conviction despite the involvement of a third party in the act. You see?
No.
You don't?
No.
Is aware that the circumstances exist, okay? Pointing a gun at somebody that's loaded. I think a rational person would say, you know, that's the circumstances, someone's going to get shot. Okay? Aware that the circumstances exist, because this is a conduct offense. All right? And that not only doesn't allow for an exception where there's been a third party intervention, it would actually, I believe, define it away and say that you can be aware that the circumstances exist and you can shoot this guy regardless of a third-party intervention, and that still fits that definition of knowingly.
Is that the definition of knowingly from the penal code?
Yes, it is.
So you're just saying in this particular case it's an incorrect statement of law?
It's adding to egregious harm, because in addition to not having the knowingly instruction or the voluntary act instruction, the knowingly instruction really kind of goes too far the other way and defines voluntary act out of existence by saying if you're just aware of the circumstances, then you're guilty.
So we need to look at that case that declared murder to be a result of the conduct offense and that it was harm to instruct on the full instruction, definition of intentional, and that it was harmful. So we look at that case to determine whether giving the full definition of knowing was harmful in the context of this situation that you're talking about.
Well, this was a deadly conduct case.
Right.
And
so it's the nature of the offense rather than the result of the offense.
Right.
So,
well, it's it's a conduct offense.
So knowingly eviscerates the intentional act. And the fact that there's no intentional act instruction makes the full definition of knowing.
You still have the voluntary conduct charge or a voluntary conduct.
Right.
Read A and then read the knowingly instruction, and you can see. And this argument that I'm making is purely to show egregious harm. Mm-hmm. This argument I'm making right now. Okay. It's not a charge argument.
Circumstances exist. I don't even understand what that means. I don't know that a jury. A person acts knowingly when he's aware of the nature of his conduct, or that the circumstances exist. That doesn't even make any sense to me.
Well, it's the legislator.
You keep him from getting an answer.
Why didn't write it?
All right. In the closing arguments now, which is Volume 6, pages 31 and then 36 and 37, the prosecutor argues if somebody grabs it, unless you know what's going to happen if they grab that gun and you've got your finger on the trigger, are you really going to pull back like he says? Is that not a reckless act? At least his finger went back, and it was at that point that David Quilos was shot with a gigantic hole that blasted through his chest. So the prosecutor argued and then turned around and argued, basically the opposite thing. But there was an argument made to the jury, and that's at page 36, that I believe exacerbates the harm as well. I don't have much time left. I guess this is 5 minutes. Is there anything else on voluntary act that the court would like to talk about? It just needs to be raised by the evidence, and it doesn't matter whether it's impeached, unbelievable. If it's just raised by the evidence, then it has to be given.
So it's just like any other defensive.
Exactly.
Okay.
Well, we'll ask opposing counsel. Clearly, there was evidence that somebody grabbed the gun and pulled it.
Mm-hmm.
So we'll ask opposing counsel: is that actually voluntary or not?
Okay.
Your position.
On causation.
Okay, let me ask you this. Is the reckless act pointing the gun, or is the reckless act pulling the trigger? Because if the reckless act is pointing the gun, which is sort of what it looks like.
Discharge. Discharging the weapon at or in the direction of.
Discharge is the.
That's the deadly conduct.
Deadly conduct.
Discharging a firearm at or in the direction of another person.
Okay, pointing the gun would just be reckless conduct.
That would be possibly a lower grade of deadly conduct.
Oh, yeah, with your
Exactly. Exactly.
He's locked and loaded, as it were.
Well, let's give you a little extra time to talk about concurrent cause. And just add that to it.
Okay. It's going to be pretty quick. The prosecutor said, or pointed out that this is a conduct offense, and I had kind of lost sight of that. And basically, I'm going to concede the concurrent cause issue. And the reason is, and this is, I've never thought of this before, 604A, a person is criminally responsible if the result would not have occurred but for his conduct, period, unless the concurrent cause was clearly sufficient to produce the result and the conduct of the actor clearly insufficient. I cannot envision how that could ever apply to a conduct-only offense. And I couldn't find anything in our law, you know, in the case law that said anything about it. But I really can't, like, for instance, an assault, how do you have a voluntary act issue on an assault, you know, by threat or on a rape or, you know, any other conduct-only offense? Now, B is the transferred intent. A person is nevertheless criminally responsible for causing a result if the only difference between what actually occurred and what's desired, blah, blah, blah. So, Justice McCoy, how's that for drafting? Result in A obviously has a much more narrow meaning than result in B, but there's nothing that interprets any of that. So that's it on concurrent cause. It's just kind of a head scratcher, but I think that voluntary act is definitely where I need to be. So thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you. Okay, Andy.
May it please the court. Your Honors, my name is Andy Porter. I'm pleased to represent the state of Texas. Am I to understand correctly that the appellant is now waiving his third point of error?
I'll let the court decide
All right.
what they want to do with that.
The court has read the briefs and has reviewed the record. I'm just going to hit the high points on the evidentiary sufficiency challenge. We have the 911 tape on which the appellant can be heard saying, "David, I'm about to kill you anyway." And then shortly thereafter, we hear the boom. I believe it's Crawford, passes by the window to the bedroom, sees the appellant with the gun.
Campbell.
Pardon?
Campbell?
Yes, ma'am, you're right. It is Campbell. I apologize. And then all the ballistics evidence and Becker's testimony and whatnot. There clearly was sufficient evidence under the Jackson v. Virginia standard, which is now what the Court of Criminal Appeals has announced in Booker. Moving on to the real meat and potatoes of this case, and that's the charge on voluntariness. The appellant has argued that the trial court erred in failing to sua sponte, give the charge on voluntariness, and then under Almanza, the harm standard, and Abnor, which guides the resolution of this. We've got a two-part test. First of all, we've got to determine, is there jury charge error? Then second of all, we have to determine if there error, then what level of harm is required to show
if there just has
error.
To be some evidence, I mean, really, I mean, it's pretty clear that there's some evidence on the voluntary issue. If that's the burden, if that's the threshold, so then we're really talking about harm, aren't we?
Correct. On harm, then it goes to either egregious harm or some harm. But actually, it's not a gut cinch that there was error in this case.
Why so?
For several reasons, Your Honor. First of all, in this case, to get to voluntariness, you have to show an involuntary act. The appellant said today, some third party or some intervening fact that shows involuntary conduct. Here, as the court is well aware, the appellant did not involuntarily point the gun at David Quiles.
He was charged with pointing the gun. He was charged with firing it. That's what I was asking.
Yes, Your Honor.
The dangerous act had been pointing the gun.
Correct.
That would be one thing.
Correct.
But if it's actually firing the gun, then why is there not some evidence that the firing of the gun was an involuntary act? No matter how incredible or how difficult to believe, why is there not some evidence of that?
I think we all agree pointing the gun didn't kill him.
Correct, Your Honor. And Justice Dovenot, your distinction under 2205 deadly conduct, subsection A and subsection B, is spot on. Here, though, if you look at the appellant's statements on the 911 tape talking about the struggle over the gun, which is what the appellant bootstraps, that's the conduct that's voluntary. He voluntarily struggled over a gun. How can you involuntarily struggle over a gun? If Quilos indeed, or let me rephrase it, if the jury indeed believed that Quilos grabbed the gun and pulled on it and that there was a subsequent struggle, then the appellant engaged in that struggle. In Hernandez v. State, a recent opinion from 2009 from the Waco Court of Appeals, there was this very issue of whether a struggle was sufficient to not require voluntary an involuntary or voluntariness instruction. And there, Felipe Reina, following the, I believe it's the Houston 1st, the Houston 14th, and maybe an Austin Court of Appeals. It was an unpublished opinion, and it's not cited in the state's brief, if that's what you're looking for, Justice McCoy. They said, given the fact that there was a voluntary struggle over the gun, and an involuntariness instruction was not required, because that voluntary struggle eviscerates any claim of jury charge error.
Well, if the struggle is, I'm pointing the gun at you, and I have my hand on the trigger, I'm squeezing the gun.
Judge. You voluntarily squeezed on the gun. If
I were you, I think I would concentrate on the degree of harm.
Yeah. This dog may not be in the lead.
Well, Your Honors, if you look at the grand scheme of things and you go through the four parts of Almanza, the jury charge error, the state of the evidence, the closing arguments, and things like that, the appellant was originally charged with murder. And honestly, I don't understand how a jury can find that he fired a gun at David Quilos but didn't kill him, because that's the only rational distinction between murder and deadly conduct in 2205B. Well, also, murder is intentionally or knowingly. Deadly conduct in 2205B is knowing.
Murder is intent to cause the result. Deadly conduct doesn't. You don't have to intend to cause the result.
Actually, you're correct. You're correct, Your Honor. You're correct. But even so, given the state of this evidence, it's hard to understand the rational distinction, but that doesn't matter. That's what the jury found, is they found him guilty of deadly conduct. But the state of the evidence is overwhelming, and the jury chose to believe that the defendant fired a weapon, whether it was as a result of a struggle or whether they believed Becker's testimony that the gunshot residue powder showed that Quilos' left hand, and he was left-handed, showed that he was covering his face at the time because there was no gunshot residue found by the medical examiner on his arm, which otherwise would have been indicated by grabbing the gun and blasting the chest. There should have been some gunshot residue on the arm. There wasn't any evidence of that. And given the arguments of counsel, they both argued that this was essentially involuntary conduct during the closing argument, which was subsumed by the knowing instruction in the jury charge. Then he got that across to the jury. The jury chose to not believe him. And given the state of the evidence, the fact that Becker's testimony, the ME's testimony about no gunshot residue, and that the positioning of the arm was such that Becker believed that there is no way, and she was very clear about that, that Quilos' hand was out extended, then the defendant cannot show egregious harm in this case. He got to argue that it wasn't voluntary, that it was a result of a struggle. The jury didn't believe him. And so in this case, had he asked for the instruction and all he had to show was some harm, I'd agree with you that there was that lesser threshold under Almanza to get there. But here he has to show egregious harm. And he can't clear that high hurdle given the state of the evidence in this case because he didn't ask for it at trial.
The fact that appellant said, I'm going to kill you, the question was whether he was going to kill him again or a little bit later. It was inevitable that he was going to pull that trigger according to his own statements while he was talking to 911.
You're correct. I think that only hurts.
Does that go to your harm analysis?
It only hurts him in being able to show egregious harm. Because it shows not just knowing, but intentional conduct, and it doesn't help show that his conduct was involuntary when right before the gunshot is heard, he says, "I'm going to kill you anyway." That doesn't help show that his conduct was involuntary, and doesn't help show egregious harm, which is required under Almanza. Thank you, Your Honors. The state asks that the court affirm the trial court's judgment.
Your Honors, the indictment was count one, manslaughter, count two, deadly conduct by discharging a weapon, and count three, criminally negligent homicide. And the jury acquitted of one and three and convicted of two. I'm a little bit baffled by that, too, just by looking at the record, you know. Perhaps so. But the record, you know, is what we have. And here is exactly what Jamie Becker said. And I'll just cut straight to the spotted dog. Okay, is what you see there and what you observed on the clothing consistent with his arm being outstretched in the general direction of the shooter? Answer, as you just demonstrated, no, sir. Okay, can you explain that? Because I'm not working in a vacuum and I am looking at what the autopsy picture looked like as well. So the shot comes in at an angle. As you depicted, you said, with the arm outstretched like this, and it can't happen that way for it to go in the sleeve and then at an angle to the chest. And then it goes on to finally say, and what you saw on the shirt tells us nothing about whether or not the person's elbow is crooked, correct? Correct. And looking at the record as we must, Jamie Becker does not categorically say anything, because we have people saying, you know, we have no idea how they were standing in that courtroom when they're doing these demonstrations. So what we have to do is infer a lot of the stuff that the prosecutor just talked about, because of the absence of gunpowder residue, this, because of this, that. There's just no evidence of that. It's probably a good idea. But you know, that's what we're stuck with. And I think there was the statement on there by Oberlander. Of course he said that, but he was saying that in response to something that Quilos was saying, using the F word and all that. I mean, I think I do have that in the brief. I think that when you combined, the fact that it was raised, the way that it was raised, the way that it was argued by the prosecutor, and the way that it was charged by the court. You know, an argument could be made that you look at that knowingly charge and the case law that supports the voluntary act, and you may say that's the only reason that he got convicted of count two. Now, I think probably we had some sort of a strange compromise going on. But nonetheless, the jury had no way to give effect to the law of voluntary act, and it was central, absolutely central to count two, and it was argued, it was testified to, and from the knowingly instruction, the way that was given, I believe that egregious harm does exist. The state has admitted some harm. I think it's egregious harm. Anything else from y'all? Thank you so much. Good
Thank
to see y'all again.
Your case is submitted, and I personally appreciate such an interesting case on the first Tuesday after Thanksgiving.
Y'all did a great job.
Would y'all spread the practice tips about trial lawyers describing, in essence, demonstrative evidence, and also that we don't have but one copy of the record? And probably don't have the penal code up here, although we should bring it. So, please attach.
Yeah, we ask for appendices. Uh-huh. Put those things in the appendix. And we've been asking, I've been asking for electronic briefs for a long time. So, if we had electronic briefs with the appendices, that would be so nice.
I will definitely do appendices in appendices in the future, and I will at least include, the stuff like for federal court. You got to give them the charge,
That's
the verdict sheet,
the
law that is in issue. I'll at least include those things every time.
And really, all you have to do is hit send on your computer to send us an email copy. You still have to file a hard copy for it to count, but if you can send us an email copy, so we have it on our computer, because sometimes we're reading these briefs at home, and if we can read it on the computer without having to lug all that stuff, then it allows us to give it a lot more time and attention. It really helps the court if you can do
and if
that.
You forget, this works too.
Yeah,
this was helpful.
Yeah, bring it with you to court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
All rise.
You are excused.
Thank you.
And we'll be in recess.